to just say thank you for all the responses that we've gotten from the people that are here, that have been here, the things that that you're gaining from this time together. It's really generated a lot of good discussion at home, as well as within our church, and we've had a lot of people talk about how they've enjoyed just, you know, every once in a while it's okay to get everybody together and to talk about something as simple as social media and screen time and all that stuff, because it affects all of us. And so tonight we're going to continue that, and Zach threw me under the bus last week and said I was going to answer all the questions that everybody had. And so I hope that what happens tonight will generate some more interest and you'll be even further invested in what we talk about. Now, also, I wanted to mention this discussion will continue in the class that I do on Wednesday night. One of the books that we've been studying as a staff, The Relentless Pursuit of...
Ruthless Elimination of Hurry.
I think I was getting into a movie or something. But, we're going to be continuing that series that we started a couple weeks before this series started. And that'll be next week over in the room across the hall. And so I encourage you, if you'd like to even have more conversation, that's where we'll spend about three more weeks on this over there. I want to begin with a prayer, and then I'll ask our panel to come up, and I'll let them introduce themselves, and we'll get started. Father, thank you for the opportunity to be here tonight and to share in our lives and to share some things of ways that we can better serve you and better get to know you. And so I pray that as we continue these conversations, that we will do everything we can to put you first in our lives and to not allow things of the world to take over our lives. And so I pray that we will encourage each other and strengthen each other and even hold each other accountable when needed. Thank you for Jesus. It's in his name we pray. Amen. I want to ask our panel to come on up and have your spots right here. And there's a microphone right there at the end you'll need to turn on. Tonight what I've done is I've asked for people that have backgrounds in counseling to help us with the discussion that we're going to be doing. And so I've used them in some other venues as well. And so it was pretty easy to call and say, hey, could you come up? We had several that were sick, and there's a lot of people that were not able to be here tonight. So I want to let them introduce themselves real quick and just tell us your name and kind of what your background with counseling is, or maybe a specific area that we've talked about that that you'll be helpful in this. Go ahead.
My name's John Cassidy, and I hope I will be helpful in any way. I'm a psychiatrist in town and a professor at ACU, and it kind of depends on where the conversation goes, how much help I will be. But I will certainly be listening, and if I can help, I will.
I will say John is always helpful. He's very humble, too. So,
my name is Carissa McCartney. I am 57 into my 60-hour Master's of Marriage and Family Therapy from Liberty University.
Did you say you were 57?
I know, I'm 57 hours into my 60-hour program.
Oh, wow.
So, sorry.
That's all right. I think other people thought the same thing.
Yeah.
She looks really good for 57.
Skin routine, you know, every night. Yeah. No, so I am in what's called my internship, and so I don't have a specialization. I take all the hours I can, and whoever wants to come see me, I see them. So, yeah, I see it all.
So she's kind of in the beginning stages of her career. So.
Yeah.
Good.
I'm Kathy Wright, and my degree is a doctorate in psychology. And my specialty area when I was therapist for about 10 years was addictions and abuse of children. And so then I raised my kids many of their years here at Hillcrest, and the technology of the iPhone arrived when my oldest son was at ACU, and they gave out the first iPhones to the kids at ACU.
And y'all may not have known that about Kathy. She doesn't talk too much about that. Maybe on purpose, I don't know. But I always know Kathy has a lot of wisdom as well. And so I want to begin by doing something that we have been talking about all this, you know, this, well, however long we've been doing it, not just for this series, but even on Sunday mornings and in our classes, just a process that's called Lectio Divina. It's something that we do as a staff before our staff meetings. And what it is reading and then doing what the best you can to interpret what God is saying for you specifically. And the other day I was reading from Ephesians 6. In fact, I don't know if you have your Bibles with you, but I want to read to you. What I like to do is look at a lot of different modern translations. And as I was reading through this one, I was thinking about exactly what we've been talking about in this class. And so what I'd like to do is just take a few moments to begin and read this, and then give you a moment, and Nathan's going to be jumping up with a microphone. Don't be afraid of the microphone. And I'd like for you to just share, what is God saying to you from what I read to you? What is the specific thing that he has said to you based on everything that we've been talking about in this series? Or maybe something that comes to you that you're going, well, I never even thought about that before. And so I want to read this to you from the Passion Translation, if you're familiar with that. And I want you to just listen. And maybe if you can close your eyes without going to sleep, please do that. You know, just try to sit back and relax and just listen to these words. And I'll pause for just 30 seconds, and it's going to seem like a lot longer. But I'm going to pause for 30 seconds just to let God speak to you personally. And I'd like for three or four of you to share, what is it that you felt like God was saying to you from this passage? So this is Ephesians 6, starting at verse 10. Now, my beloved ones, I have saved these most important truths for last. Be supernaturally infused with strength through your life union with the Lord Jesus. Stand victorious with the force of his explosive power flowing in and through you. Put on God's complete set of armor provided for us, so that you will be protected as you fight against the evil strategies of the accuser. Your hand-to-hand combat is not with human beings, but with the highest principalities and authorities operating in rebellion under the heavenly realms. For they are a powerful class of demon gods and evil spirits that hold this dark world in bondage. Because of this, you must wear all the armor that God provides, so you're protected as you confront the slanderer. For you are destined for all things and will rise victorious. Put on truth as a belt to strengthen you to stand in triumph. Put on holiness as the protective armor that covers your heart. Stand on your feet alert, then you'll always be ready to share the blessings of peace. In every battle, take faith as your wraparound shield, for it is able to extinguish the blazing arrows coming at you from the evil one. Embrace the power of salvation's full deliverance like a helmet to protect your thoughts from lies. And take the mighty razor-sharp spirit sword of the spoken word of God. Pray passionately in the Spirit as you constantly intercede with every form of prayer at all times. Pray the blessings of God upon all his believers. So if you just raised your hand, and it's always hard to get the first one to do it. So one of you jump out there. As you heard those words, what really jumped out at you? What was something that just really said something to you? Over here.
Uh, I think that the thing that jumps out at me that God's saying there is in every minute of my life, I am involved in a battle that I need His armor. I need His protection. I need His strength. And we've got to depend on Him. I've got to depend on Him in everything and not try to section off my life and, no, I can handle this and I need His help here. I need His armor and His strength everywhere.
Yeah, we're always in a battle, right? Very good, good. Dan, you had something?
What I got out of it was everything he said, but the reason behind us needing all this armor is to keep ourselves in a place where we can recognize the Spirit within us doing all the good stuff that we do, because our job is not just protecting us, and that's not why Paul gave us all these thoughts. Our job is to pray for everybody and help everybody in the whole world, and we can't do that if we're attacked by anything. Ergo, the armor all the time to keep one little spot in you completely unadulterated by the world and everything else, so that you can be in touch with the Spirit.
Yeah, yeah, good. Thank you. Somebody else, one more through the back.
I recently did a lesson on this in the chapel Sunday evening, and I emphasized that it's important to have the armor on, and the armor closet is the Bible.
Yeah, yeah. Think about, in light of everything that we've talked about, how important, I mean, we're in a battle, right? There's a lot of things that we are in a battle with in this world, and as we've talked all this time, you know, Satan can take something that was meant for good and turn it into a battle for us. He can take something that can be used as a tool for good and turn it into a battle for us. And so we face those things all the time. Give me a couple more. Just a couple more thoughts. One over here. And we're trying to use the microphone so the recording can hear and everybody else.
Get all of these tools listed and get set to fight against this bad dude, and you will have peace.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Thank you. Thank you. One more. Somebody else? Maybe one more. Okay. Right up here.
The one that struck me tonight was the helmet of salvation. And your version, I can't remember how it worded it, does a better job, I think, of letting us know we're saved. We've got to know that we're saved. You know, that's not a struggle we should have anymore. We should know that we're saved, and that's huge. And it's right on top of our head. I wonder why it's protecting our head. Maybe, you know, it's something that we have to know.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good. Very good. Thank you. Thank you, Nathan. Let me share these things with you. We'll pass this down that way. Let me share some thoughts with you, and then we'll get into specifics. This is what you guys have all said. Number one, we're in a battle against Satan and his army. You know, the Bible says, be alert and of sober mind. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, looking for someone to devour. And as I mentioned earlier, when we're talking about things like social media and the internet and all of the different things that we talked about, screen time, you know, those are not sinful things, but they're being used sinfully by us. And so we've got to figure out how do we do our best to be in this battle. And that's what I liked about reading from Ephesians 6. It talks about the importance of preparing for that battle and being ready for that battle, which I'll talk about here in a second. Second thing is this: there's nothing new under the sun. You know, Ecclesiastes talks about that. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun. And as we were thinking about all these different aspects of how social media and the news and everything affects us, this is nothing new. The technology is new, but the problems that we're having, it's not a new problem. We've always had pride. We've always had selfishness. We've always had things that we've been battling since the beginning of time. And so there's nothing new under the sun that, it hasn't been approached. It's just kind of a new way to look at it. And Satan can use everything he can to bring new things in. And then lastly, this one I think is the point of everything that we're really trying to say, is we need to be proactive and not passive about this. You know, it's real easy, and I know this from a couple of grandsons, you know, it's real easy to let screens become babysitters. You know, it's real easy to pass it, and you see this all the time when you go to any restaurant or maybe even in church, you know, it's easy to pass that screen off to a child, and that keeps them busy for, you know, long enough so you can do what you need to do. Or if you're eating dinner in a restaurant, like I said, you see that, or wherever you need to have a quick babysitter, it's real easy to put that screen out there. As we think about that, that's kind of being passive instead of proactive. We're trying to figure out how can we stress the importance of being proactive in things like social media and screen time. We've got to be proactive in that. I thought about this verse immediately because we've been talking about Romans 12. Embracing what God does for you is the best thing you can do for Him. Don't become so well adjusted to your culture that you fit into it without even thinking. Does that have a little bit to do with what we've been talking about? Instead, fix your attention on God. You'll be changed from the inside out. That was what we just said. Readily recognize what He wants from you and do what? Quickly respond to it. So be proactive. If we see there's something wrong in our world, we need to be proactive. That's what I appreciate about what we did. There's some issues involving screen time and social media and all the things surrounding it. They're not bad, but there's a problem. We've allowed it to consume our lives. And so we've got to figure out, how can we change that? Well, it begins with us. It begins with us as families, as singles, as wherever you're at. It begins with us. So I want to try to figure out this question, because this is where we wanted to get to. So what can we do? We've addressed it. We've said there's a problem with it, that we're not here to bash it, but there's a lot of problems that come with screen time and social media and bullying and, you know, all the things that we could list that have happened. So what can we do? Well, I'm going to give you four things, and I'm going to ask these guys to help me describe these things. First thing is this, and you're doing that by being here tonight and being here the last 3 weeks. The first thing is, we got to prepare. As I read that verse, it says, be supernaturally infused with strength through your life union with the Lord Jesus. So we begin that preparation first by making sure we're right with Jesus. It's not going to do us any good to try to tell others they need to do it if we're not right with Him yet. And so we begin that process of preparation by making sure we're good in that area. Now, here's the questions I want to ask and get some help with. So as we're looking at this, trying to prepare, what are some ways that parents and individuals can prepare for this battle ahead of time? In this group, we've got all ages. We've got people with grandchildren, great-grandchildren. We've got parents with young children. We've got people that don't have children yet, you know, so we have to think about, what can we do to prepare in each of those areas? What are ways that parents and individuals can prepare for this battle that we're talking about ahead of time? How can people, parents, handle it that are in the midst of it right now? You may be in the middle of that battle right now with your kids. You may have kids that are fairly young that are already asking for cell phones. By the way, that age is getting younger and younger all the time. You may have teenagers that, you know, walk around with this, and you're trying to figure out, how do I get their attention? How do I do that without alienating them, you know? Because it's such a part of their culture, as we mentioned. How do you do that? So I'm going to turn it over to these guys a little bit. You can pick either one, whichever. What are some suggestions you have on ways that parents and individuals can prepare specifically for this? Not everybody at once.
I'm not a parent.
You got it.
Yeah, so I'm not a parent yet, so naturally I am the perfect parent. I know all the right answers and all the theories. But as far as when I was kind of reflecting and thinking through some of these, I thought a lot about how sometimes for me, when I think about these subjects, like how fear can just kind of seep in and creep in. And then fear starts to dominate how I act or how I handle a situation. And so probably what I would encourage y'all, and I'm sure you guys are already doing these things, is like recognizing when fear is starting to creep into your conversations, both with your friends and with your kids and with yourself. And notice, like, kind of wondering, okay, am I thinking about this, or have I started letting fear take the lead here? That's a big one for me, of just kind of recognizing how to recognize that, and then how to take a step back and say, okay, fear's in control right now, so I need to take a step back and not do anything rash or act too swiftly until I know that I'm back in the lead.
So one of the ways we can prepare is to recognize when fear comes in, right, whether it's ourself or even our children, mm-hmm, that becomes part of the equation. That's when we know we need to do something.
Right.
Good. Thank you.
I take that first question to mean ahead of time, meaning before the child is mature enough to say, I really mean it when I say I want a phone. I want a phone that's connected to the internet, as opposed to a little plastic thing, calculator that we pretend are phones, because they're doing that really early. But when, before that child is accessing the internet, what can we be doing ahead of time? And there's this wonderful study called the Still Face Experiment, where there's a baby in front of his mama, and the mama is responding in synchrony, eye to eye, face to face, motion to emotion. And then the experimenter says, now still your face, and the experimenter goes blank. The mama goes blank. And the baby is still trying to engage the mom. And when you watch that, the baby gets more and more agitated, and finally is screaming and reaching and pointing, mama, look, aren't we sharing the same context anymore? And then eventually the mom's allowed to respond again, and the baby's immediately soothed. So what's happening right now with mama's breastfeeding, or even just sitting in a room where a child is playing, what used to be a time to engage eye to eye in synchrony has become a time when the mom might think, oh, it's just a break, let me just check my email, because it's so soothing to touch your email and to touch your little phone. It just soothes them all. And so then you have a mama who's still face and doesn't realize it. And this baby isn't getting the synchrony, and it just happens over and over and over again. And that eventually affects that child's emotional development. So ahead of time, what can we do? We can say, I love technology, I really do. When I'm creating something, I usually have two laptops open. I'm looking at something here, I'm writing something here, and I have my phone available to look up things I want to look up. So technology is useful, but communicate to a child what it's used for. So with my 4-year-old grandson in the room, if he wants to know, what does a baby deer sound like? I say, let's do some research. And then we look it up and we play the video, but that's research, that's not just whiling away the hours. It's research when we go to that phone. And to be really intentional about when you're using your technology. And if you have to do still face in front of a child, and they're going to get agitated and want more and more, you just have to say, I'm setting a timer, and in 10 minutes I'm going to pay attention to you, but for 10 minutes I'm going to be on this because I have to get this work done. So I'll be back. Just go ahead and play, and I'll be there. Then you don't have that constant pull and conflict of, is it me or the technology that you're after here? And so if you can be conscientious about the boundaries you're setting and not let the phone decide when you're interacting, so know when the phone is in another room, you're available, and when you need to check your phone, be there. So you're modeling it from a very early age. And I think that prepares a child to realize that this phone is very useful. It's a wonderful technology tool. And also, it can provide the information and the excitement that we need when we need it. But it's not going to be a constant distraction, and I don't use it to soothe myself.
So it's amazing how something as simple as eye contact can have a dramatic impact on cognitive development. That's really interesting, even, you know, just Because that's it, when we're looking at our phones, we're typically non-reactionary. Mm-hmm. Unless we have good news or bad news or, you know, something like that, or a funny cat video, you know, pops up. But, you know, most of the time we're kind of stone-faced.
Yeah.
And we've probably all seen parents like that, whether we're, you know, in the public, we'll see kids going, mom, 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 you know, and the parents right here.
And even if we do show emotion, it's not in synchrony with what the child is doing, so it doesn't educate them. The normal emotional development would be that the child has a sad face, and then the mama mirrors that back sad face, and then the child knows, when I get that feeling inside, it looks like that. And so when he sees a face that looks like that again, he says, oh, that person feels this. As they grow up, they develop empathy by that synchrony. And so for a parent to be laughing when the child is crying out is more the experience of having a schizophrenic mother or someone who's using drugs or alcohol, where they're responding inappropriately to your face.
Interesting. Yeah. John, thoughts?
Well, I like what both have said, because they're important, and I think maybe, I'm not sure this is going to be as emotionally in tune as all the others. I think one of the things you can do to prepare yourself is to decide what you want to teach your kids. you can teach your kids a lot of things that are appropriate for kids that are utterly inappropriate for adults. That, you know, once they grow up, if you've taught them too well, they're going to have a hard time adjusting because they've been overtaught as kids. If you teach them that the cell phone is evil, that's probably not a good lesson for them to learn. If you teach them that the cell phone is truth, that's not a good lesson for them to learn. Right? The cell phone has always been a challenge to me, or the iPad or the computer, whatever, because I read in the Bible where it says a good tree does not bear bad fruit. Guess what? iPhones can be used to have your Bible on it. I use YouVersion on my iPad. It's a wonderful thing. I also know that it doesn't take too many touches of that screen before I can bring out some of the worst filth that this planet has to offer. It comes out of the same thing. So that lesson, I find that a challenging lesson. And to teach a child appropriately for their age that there are good things on this and things that you can enjoy and there are things you can have fun in, there are things we can engage with together, and it is a wonderful experience. And there may be times when you see things that confuse you or make you feel unhappy, and you know what? That's okay. You can bring it to me, and we'll figure out what to do with it. These things don't have to scare us. They don't have to be, sometimes we worry that something's going to show up on the screen and it's going to change our children forever. It doesn't have to. Some of it may be inappropriate for their age. And we can talk about that. This is not the kind of picture that someone of your age should be looking at. Or this isn't the kind of story that is made for someone of your age. Or this is, this is not what we believe to be the truth. And when we decide, how do I want my child to interact with this? Do I want them to fear it? Do I want them to love it? Or do I want them to recognize that it is a tool that can be used for good and can be used for evil, and I want you to know how to use it right?
And I think that goes back, thank you for saying that, I think that goes back to us being proactive, and doing the things like you guys have said, modeling what we want them being comfortable with, but at the same time, setting boundaries for ourselves so that they'll understand what that means to have those boundaries. And we can actually use the cell phone to teach how to use a cell phone. There's all kinds of information out there that you can look up that will help you prepare for whatever age range your kids or grandkids are so that you can help them understand that. So again, it goes back to how we use it. Let me go to the next step. The next thing I want to talk about is protect. This is what we just said earlier. Put on God's complete set of armor provided for us so that you will be protected as you fight against the evil strategies of the accuser. So one of the things we have to do is we have to protect ourselves as well as our kids. And so, and not just families, but individuals. I mean, how can an individual protect themselves from the negative side of screen time? Zach mentioned one time about there's an app that will tell you how much screen time you've used. Do you remember the name of that, Zach? What is that?
It's literally a function on your phone.
Oh, it's actually a setting on the phone.
It's called screen time.
So it's already there. It's called screen time. If you want to know what your screen time was that week or that, you know, it'll tell you. And so you have that ability to know. And you can kind of, it doesn't take long to figure out how much time you've used. So you think about this, the importance of protection for yourself. We talk to everything to our kids about protecting them from stranger danger and all, you know, all the different things that we talk about. We need to be just as proactive as you were just saying in teaching them about proper usage of screen time and things like that. So how can an individual protect themselves? How does a parent or grandparent protect their families from the negative influence in social media, but also point them to the positive side? How does that process work? John, you would start us out, we'll go that way.
Well, you know, when you sent us the slide set, I am sorry to say that I saw the slides and I went, uh-oh, my brain is going in a different direction. It's not a different direction that says the slides are wrong. It's a different direction than the words kind of go. When it says put on the whole armor of God, what are we dressing for? Right?
A battle.
Sometimes, well, you say a battle, but you know, the battle I think looks different from what we often think the battle looks like. Sometimes people put on armor because they're afraid. Right? They're afraid that something really nasty is out there and I gotta put a lot of stuff between me and it. We don't have to be afraid. I don't think we're putting on armor to be afraid. But we need to watch out that we don't get tricked to thinking we are. Sometimes people put on battle so they can run roughshod over everyone else who doesn't have the armor on. We are not called to run roughshod. The way my mind was going, where I saw the battle, when Jesus went out and saw the leper and he walked up to the leper and touched him, that was the battle. That was it right there. There was something unclean out there, and if most of the people who were in Israel had gone out and touched that person, they would become unclean. Guess what? Jesus is the example of the fully armored person, and there ain't nothing on this planet that can make him unclean. He can touch lepers. He can have prostitutes come wash his feet and throw perfume all over him, and everyone else can go, oh man, you know, if he was really holy, he would know. And Jesus goes, yes, I'm really holy, and I'm really holy regardless of who I touch and regardless of who touches me. And that, I know we're talking Jesus, and we're talking the end all of what we're aiming for. But that's what we're aiming for. If you have the mind of Christ, if you have the armor of God, there's nothing that a cell phone or an iPad will show you that will make you unclean.
But.
No, not a but. There won't be. Now, knowing that we haven't reached there, there may be things we want to stay away from. There may be things where we say to our kids, I don't read this site. Not because this site is more powerful than God or more powerful than anything else. I don't read this site because that's a weakness for me. And I do not need to expose myself to weakness. And I think the idea that the battle looks like I help people. The battle looks like I redeem people. The battle looks like I love, not I fear, not I conquer. I love. And if I'm armored well, I don't have to worry about being unclean or being
forever damaged.
Damaged
yeah.
by my effort to do this.
Yeah. And I think that goes back to our first point, which is preparing our kids for those times where they may see something that they know is wrong, but they don't know why, or, you know, that goes back to the prepare part. And so yeah, pretend. There's a lot of different reasons for wearing that armor. Good. Charisma?
Yeah, so protecting from the negative side, my first thought is, okay, have we defined the negative side? Have we sat around as a family unit and talked about what the negative side is? Is my definition the same as Zach's definition? Is my definition the same as my mom's definition? And where is there room for compromise on some of that? Is there some things, like John was saying earlier, that are age appropriate for some people and not age appropriate for others? And so there might be a little bit of different definitions. And sometimes the idea of communication feels like a really simple idea. But when it actually comes to doing it, sometimes we forget that, oh, my mind is working a million miles an hour and it all connects in here. And what I'm saying through here, is it all connecting the way that I mean for it to in my brain? And so if I am talking to Zach, is Zach getting the message that I want him to get, or are we on the same page? Or if I just assumed, oh, yeah, Zach knows what I'm talking about, I don't have to explain it. Like, we all feel the same way, and the idea is that we all are different and we all have different definitions. And so I kind of go back to just defining it and having involving, especially I feel like with families, one thing that I really appreciated with my parents and growing up is I felt part of family decisions, whether or not I was in actuality. That's a different story, you can ask my parents that later. But I remember a specific time. I'll give a quick example of a new church. We'd been going to a church that was about 20 minutes down the road from where we were, and a church that we had worked with, while they didn't have a building, was building a building really close to our house. And my parents set me and my brother down, and they were like, okay, so this is a closer church. We know some people here. Would y'all like to move to this church? And I remember my mom tells a story when I'm witnessing her and my dad were not prepared for the overwhelming reaction that me and my brother had. We were like, what are you talking about? This is our home. Buckingham is our home. That's like where we grew up. That's where all our friends are. And whether or not my parents were actually considering moving churches or not, I don't know, but they took it upon themselves not to just decide, but actually take our input and be transparent with us where they were coming from, why they were considering it, why they were there. And that left a very special impact on me. Just feeling that I was a part of this family instead of something that's being tugged behind. So being transparent and involving every member of the family as you can, as best as you can.
And it's amazing what happens when we communicate, right? You know, we talk and share and all those things. That's a part of that protection. Because in that process, we're protecting ourselves from things that may hurt us, and it helps us to share what those things are and communicate about those things. And that's how we end up protecting each other in that. Yeah, good. Kathy, quick thoughts?
So I'm going to bounce off of what you said. Then in terms of this research study where some people actually tried to find out what changed kids' attitudes about their internet use. And so they knew that over 70% of kids in the ages of 13 to 17 who had phones were messaged by someone they didn't know. And 40% of kids responded to that by chatting to the person that they didn't know. So this researcher was trying to find out what would change their awareness of that, and also the awareness that marketers are tracking them, because marketers can't track kids who are 12 and under, but they can track teenagers. And so what would make kids aware that that was risky for them and not want to engage in any of that? And so they just interviewed kids in high school and asked them about things that happened at home in terms of their parental practices. And so they had some kids who just had rules about their phone use, and they had other kids who had parents who would sit down and scroll with them, look at the screen with them, and then they had other parents who let the kids make a lot of the decisions, but they had discussions with them also. And then they had overlap. You could have rules and discussion, you could have scrolling and rules and all the different varieties. And they found that the kids who had changed attitudes about the risks they were involved in when they allowed themselves to be tracked by e-marketers, and when they got a text from someone they didn't know, the kids who actually changed their attitude about whether or not that was risky had parents who were, I'm sure you can guess, having discussions about it. That was the main predictor. And scrollers, people would sit and scroll with them, would also influence that attitude, but rules didn't influence their attitudes at all. They just obeyed when they couldn't, when they might get caught, and then when they might not get caught, they didn't obey. So I kind of wanted to, as I was preparing this, I thought, I don't know how much of a story I can tell you about this, but let me just intimate it. That maybe when you were a teenager, did you break any rule at all of your parents?
Never.
Maybe that's all I need to say about it. But the rules don't really stop our behavior, but the relationships in which we're coached and scaffolded and we learn how to make decisions are what influence our behavior. I just remember as a kid being in a family that where there was alcoholism and not Christianity, hanging around with some girls where there was Christianity. And those girls weren't that different than me in terms of what we wanted to do. And there were times when we would go into one of their parents' houses and get access to something that we shouldn't have access to, but they knew there was a rule against it, but it was really exciting to us to break the rule. That actually made it more appealing that it was a rule and we were breaking the rule was part of the fun of doing that. So when people try to stop uses of substances or whatever in the community, if they put out media messages that say, this will hurt you, this is very risky, don't smoke, don't drink, don't use drugs, because remember the old ad of this is your brain on drugs and the fried eggs and all that, they would find that adults in the community would lower use if media went out like that, but teens would increase use when that media went out, because teens found that very exciting to do the risky thing. And so how do you prevent with kids? How do you prevent with teens? And they found that what worked was when you convinced teens that you're being exploited by the tobacco company. And they made these jerky videos with the old kind of on-your-shoulder video machines. It looked like that, like a homemade video was being made, and they took this video machine down by the tobacco company and they threw body bags in front of it, and then the tobacco company was there, and it was teenagers that were, it looked like a teen-made video, and the teens were making the message, we won't let them exploit us. Your generation isn't going to exploit our generation. So being able to let teens lead in the messaging to teens about the risks and the exploitation that's happening, and letting that exploitation message be about what's outside of our family, what's outside of your generation, rather than it's one generation trying to control another generation with rules.
And that goes back to that protecting side of things. Mm-hmm. You know, as you were telling the earlier part, I was thinking about, you know, we protect our kids and say, don't talk to strangers and all that.
But for some reason, it's different when it's on the phone. And so we do have to be thinking about that. And those messages just keep coming, you know. And so I'm going to go ahead and move on. The next thing, at some point, you have to just practice. You know, you have to just do what you say you're going to do. Stand on your feet alert, it says, and you'll always be ready to share the blessings of peace. You know, as we've talked about this, we can talk about it till we're blue in the face, but until we actually do something about preparing our families, protecting our families, there comes a time where we have to practice it, where we have to do it. Not only do we have to practice it, but we have to practice what we preach. As we mentioned earlier, you know, if we're telling our kids, get off your phone, but we're always on our phones, that's going to be a mixed message. And I'm sure you have a study that probably talks about that. You know, we've got to make sure that our mixed messages don't get across because we've got to practice what we preach. So what are some best practices you guys have seen for families that they can use to guard against overuse, addictive type things? What are some things that you guys have seen on that? And how can parents practice what they preach when it comes to things like social media? Carissa, why don't you start us out?
Okay. So what I kind of think about with the best practices for practicing what you preach, I think that iPhones and media is not just addictive for kids. Like you were saying, it's addictive for everybody, and that it can be used for good or for bad by everybody. And so when you sit down and your family and you guys are making the boundaries you're going to follow or deciding how you guys as a family are going to function, are you being accountable for your actions and kind of following what you as a family decide too? Is kind of like if there's a thing of, okay, during dinner, you know, we're going to have phones like in the kitchen. We're going to leave phones in the kitchen or, you know, whatever. It's like, okay, are you following that as well? Are you participating in that with the rest of your family? But then also I think about like, if like with communication, is communication open both ways? Like if you are getting to know your kids and trying to understand them, are they allowed to come to you guys with questions and understanding as well? Again, that's something that I really appreciated from my parents. I was the but why child. I always wanted the, okay, you said this, but I don't, it's not connecting in my brain. I want more. I want more information. And for the most part, my parents are human, but for the most part, they were gracious to try to give me the whys or try to explain, or I was allowed to ask them questions or them things too. And that I found that to be very beneficial for me.
And that goes back to the communication again, just talking about it. Amazing. What happens when we just talk about things? Yeah, Kathy, you have any thoughts? How do we practice this?
Yeah. Well, I would say get behind the behavior and look at the motivation for the behavior. It's not a phone you're addicted to. It's the experience on the phone. And one teen is addicted to pornography on the phone. Another one's addicted to gaming on the phone. Another one is addicted to the social media likes on the phone. And we can go on and on to what about that phone is a draw. But in the end, the phone is designed, if you've watched the Social Dilemma, you can see the phone is designed to give you intermittent reinforcement, just like a gambling, what do you call this thing?
Slot machine,
yeah. It'll give you the same reinforcement, and it's designed to do that, and to give it in intervals that allow just the right number of rewards so that you keep coming back. If it rewarded you every single time you looked at it, as soon as it stopped rewarding you, you would stop using it, so you wouldn't get addicted to it. You would say, oh, the rewards are off, I'm off. But because the rewards come sometime every 2 times you touch it, sometimes every 5 times, then it'll come every three time, and then it'll come on a seventh time. You never know when it's going to pay off, so you have to keep doing it in a gambling kind of way. So if you want to, as a family, have a prevention or a good modeling of it, you're going to have to find out what exactly is going on that's a draw, and then take that apart specifically. It's not just a phone you're addressing. You're addressing what's in that phone and what it's giving you, and then individually address that component. And I love this study. Sorry about if you have sleep issues and you're having trouble sleeping. This University of Colorado just took people out in tents, and they reset their sleep schedules very easily by just sleeping to the natural rhythms of nature for a few days, and then people's circadian rhythm was reset. And I really like nature as a reset. It's very easy to say, oh, we don't have internet, we're out camping, and to just remove phones for a while and get some reset. When you come back, there'll still be this burst of desire, and you'll still have to deal with the addiction if it's there. But a reset is easy if you let your environment produce the constraint, and the phone's not really just sitting there waiting to be used. It's really gone for a while. So I think nature as a reset is always a good best practice.
Yeah, how many cool stories came from the power outage that we had, you know, a couple of years ago, whatever it was, of families that came together in ways they had never done before. They got that reset you're talking about. Good. John, quick thoughts?
Yeah, I think this is going to be quick because I'm not sure what I can add to what's already been said. I'd say the different generations don't use their iPhones and their tablets for the same reason. I don't have a Facebook page, and I'm very happy I do not. I had a Twitter for like 2 weeks. I don't even know my password anymore.
Some people are on Tinder.
I do not use my phone and my iPad for anything that my daughter uses hers for. It's just the generations are very different. But can I be honest for why I use it and for what I search and for what I use it? And if she doesn't understand why I don't like to go to Google to find out what's going on in the world, can I be honest with her and tell her what I think the good and the bad is of trusting a commercial product to try to serve me up what reality is? I think if I can be honest with her and listen honestly at why she uses her iPad for what she uses it for, I think that'd be helpful. The other thing, and this one's hard. Our phones and our electronic media, they don't deliver real rewards. Now, they can kind of. If you shop on Amazon, they can bring real rewards to your house. But most of the stuff that's offered online is fake. Now, but you know what? You might be tempted to say, oh, but we are adults. We are not subject to fake rewards. Yes, we are. You know what the biggest fake reward we got is? Money. Little pieces of paper. They're not anything. They can burn up. The only reason that they're worth anything is that we have agreed that they're worth something. When we show our stack of cash to our neighbor, the neighbor goes, wow, that's really worth that cash. When our kids say, I got 300 followers, all of their friends go, wow, that's a whole bunch of followers. It doesn't mean anything.
So it goes back to motivation.
Yeah, it goes back to motivation. And we're all susceptible to the fake reward. Whether it's the number on our cell phone that says, I have 2,000 friends. No, you don't. I have three. you know, but we are all susceptible to this. And to help our kids and ourselves know, these things may feel good, but I need to be in contact with real rewards. I need real friends who I know their name and we talk together. I need real food, not just a picture of what someone got at Chipotle the other night and decided to post. Stay in contact with the real rewards and make sure the kids are valuing the real rewards better than the fake ones.
I think that's some great things to really think about. And the question, what is my motivation? Is it more friends? Is it more followers? Is it, what is my motivation?
More approval.
More approval. You know, I think that's a really good point to maybe look at each person in our circle, whether it's a family, whether it's friends, asking that question: what is our real motivation for having that screen time? Let me finish this out here. This is one really we probably should have started with. But in this particular passage, he uses it at the very end, I think on purpose. He says, pray passionately in the Spirit as you constantly intercede with every form of prayer only when you're in crisis. Oh, did I change that? I did. Only when things are just kind of bad. Now, what does it say? At all times. At all times. So prayer is going to be one of the most important things I believe we can do here. So I was curious, and I don't know if we'll have time for all three of you, but think about if you have a particular story or something that has, have you ever had something that you know of for sure, that you saw prayer make a difference in just helping families deal with some of these issues that we're talking about? How does prayer enter into that?
When we were in Albuquerque, we used to do rock climbing with some friends. And when we were rock climbing, sometimes you'd get up kind of far and get very, very afraid. And your leg would just start moving like a sewing machine needle. And it was actually called sewing machine needle leg, where it would just start bouncing. And it was because you were in the most scary situation ever. And then eventually it would stop and you could keep climbing. But you'd just get so tired and so nervous that it would just go. I was teaching at Cisco, and in the back row, I was just sitting there showing a kind of summary video. We're all done with the semester and just watching that video. And I thought, I'll just sit in the back and watch. And while I was sitting back there, I saw this girl, and her leg was doing that sewing machine needle. And then I looked over, and the next one was, and the next one was, and the whole back row was doing sewing machine needle leg. And I thought, this whole generation. And then I looked at this one girl. She's fallen asleep in the video. She fell asleep, and then her leg started going. Before she even woke up, her leg was going. And then she would stop, and then she'd fall asleep again, and her leg would be going. And I realized that physiologically, these people have been reset for anxiety. And they can't turn it off by just thinking differently, choosing cognitions and thoughts that make them no longer anxious. Physiologically, their brains, for whatever reason, have been wired for anxiety, and it's very hard to overcome. Well, the overcome for that is to have an antidote of a meditative practice where you wire your body to use the other side of it, not that sympathetic nervous system that gets you ready for fight or flight, but the parasympathetic nervous system to be your natural response. So maybe it's going to take a long meditation each day, but at first, just even 3 minutes a day would make a difference of meditative prayer, where you're just practicing the presence of God, sitting in the presence, and allowing your parasympathetic nervous system, your peace, rest, and digest part, to take over and build that neural chaining, that will make a difference, and you'll be able to override the part of your body that's more practiced in the opposite of that. So for my family and for my life, meditative prayer is prevention of being in a crisis or being in an anxious situation and not being able to manage my emotions during that, although certainly there are plenty of situations where I feel overwhelmed. But it's not what you do, like you said, in a crisis or at a moment
when you need God suddenly, but it's that you have committed to a practice of wiring your brain and your soul to the peace of God and the presence of God. And that can't be done suddenly in crisis, and suddenly you're able. It's something that you're built to build in by the practice of prayer.
Is that why I said be still and know that I am God? Does something have to do with that? Okay, we have time for one more thought. I'll let y'all fight over arm wrestle, whichever one.
I don't know how to put this in a few words, but I'll try to just put it in a few words. I think it's sometimes dangerous when people pray in certain ways, because I don't know if you've ever done it, but when you pray and as you go through prayer, you start feeling like all the things you ought to do, and you start taking responsibility for everything, and it feeds into hurry disease.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, being able to pray, you know, let me, you know, give me the things that make me better, and take from me the things that make me worse. You know, that may sound selfish, but I think all too often we are just ready to beat ourselves up for not helping every homeless person in Heavenly, or for not giving as much as, you know, the other person next to us or whatever, instead of saying, you know, God said, or Jesus particularly said, I come to give life. So what comes out of our electronics that gives life? That's wonderful. And let's be thankful for it. And if we find something that comes out of our electronics that interferes with our life, that robs us of our relationships, that robs us of our self-control, then let's be aware of it and ask that it be taken away. God will give us plenty to do without us having to add to his list.
Thank you. Let me share this with you to close out. Many of you know Richard Beck, and John Barton sent us this the other day. If you haven't subscribed to any of his blogs or different things, he's got some really interesting things to say. And I thought what I would do is just share this with you to kind of close our time out. Listen to what it's interesting timing for what he says here. There's a famous quote about the impact of hidden lives upon history from George Eliot. The growing good of the world is partly dependent on unhistoric acts, and that things are not so ill with you and me as they might have been is half owing to the number who live faithfully a hidden life and rest in unvisited tombs. More than anything, hidden lives are what gives me hope when I despair about the church. Specifically, the stories about church that hit your news and social media feeds are the stories of high-profile disasters. For obvious reasons, these negative stories get a lot of traffic, exactly what the monetized algorithms of social media need to make money manipulating our attention. Beyond capturing our attention, this filtering of the news also creates a cognitive bias called selection bias, where we lose track of the true baseline of reality and begin to assume what we see on the news is a statistical norm. That's what Zach was talking about last week. By only highlighting disasters, we come to think all of life is a disaster. This is what is behind the common refrain, Twitter's not real life. Being too online can distort your perceptions, including your perceptions of church. What never trends on Twitter are the hidden lies that you find everywhere in local churches. Visit any church and ask about who the quiet, faithful saints are within that community. People of heroic kindness, generosity, service, and fidelity. You will be flooded and overwhelmed by the stories you will hear. And none of this will ever be seen on social media. No one will ever make a podcast about any of this. And this, I keep reminding myself, is what church is. Church isn't found in what I'm seeing on social media. Church is found in the hidden lives the world will never see.
just a reminder, as we live our lives and we allow things to influence our lives, let's make sure that we are in control of those things. Let's do what we can to bring the right stuff into the right stuff in our lives. Let me close this out with a prayer. Father, thank you for the time that we have been together intergenerationally discussing the importance of things that have affected our culture, have helped us, but also have hurt us. I pray that we will communicate and talk and discuss even more about the things that we all have in common and the things that make a difference in our lives, both positively and negatively. I pray that you will lead us into truth, as we've talked about tonight. I pray that we will continue to prepare our lives, to prepare those around us to deal with the things that we face. I pray that we will protect our families, ourselves, in dealing with many things that we face. Help us in all things to put you first and to do all we can to live for you. Thank you for Jesus. It's in his name we pray. Amen. Thank you to our panel. Give them a hand for being up here.